Welcome. This is History Extra on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Our first article is The Face Fixation. From a Stone Age Venus and an Egyptian death mask to an unflinching, challenging 21st century sculpture, Faye Bound Alberti introduces seven depictions of the face that track humanity's ever-evolving relationship with creativity, hierarchy, and self-image. First, the art of darkness. This enigmatic head is a 25,000-year-old testament to the innate urge to capture the essence of a person in art. In 1894, an archaeologist called Edward Piette walked into a cave in the village of Brassampuy in southwest France and came face to face with humanity's distant past. Lying in the darkness was a fragment of mammoth ivory carved to depict a head. The head was tiny, so small that it could nestle in the palm of Piette's hand, and yet it had survived for 25,000 years, carved by an artist deep in the Paleolithic period. Piette couldn't have been aware of it at the time, but he had just discovered one of the earliest known representations of a human face in art. That representation is both awe-inspiring and deeply enigmatic. It would soon be known as the Venus of Brassampuy. There are other Venuses in the same cave with those rounded hips and breasts associated with fertility symbols, and yet we can't even be sure if it depicts a woman. Despite these uncertainties, the fact that this rare and portable object exists at all tells us that it was important for the artist to capture something of the essence of a person, and with a level of detail that it is unusual for a Venus figurine. That depth of detail is most evident in the intricate checkerboard-patterned hair, possibly a wig or hood, from which the object derives its nickname, the Lady with the Hood. The face, by comparison, is a blank canvas. It is a prominent forehead, nose, and brow, but it lacks a mouth. Was this artistic decision influenced by convention, religion, personal style, time? We do not know. What we do know is the Venus of Brassampuy stands as a symbol of how representations of the face have evolved over 25,000 years. Today, we take it for granted that our face represents us, a phenomenon I have termed facehood. It is marked on our passports and unlocks our mobiles. It is captured in photographs countless times over our lifetime. It has become shorthand for a unique individual person in a way that simply wasn't the case with the Venus of Brassampuy. 2. From Death to Deity. King Tut's dazzling mask was designed to transform a mortal man into a god. In ancient Egypt, memorializing people did not mean remembering what they looked like. It was wealth, power, and similarity to the gods that mattered. For proof, look no further than one of the most recognizable objects, King Tut's golden burial mask. Revealed in 1925 by British archaeologist Howard Carter, 3 years after he discovered King Tut's tomb, this dazzling artifact measures 54 centimeters high, a fit for an average adult head. Weighing over 10 kilograms, the mask is made of solid gold with intricate inlays of lapis and carnelian. Yet the most intriguing feature is its 2.5 kilograms golden beard. That beard, which is long and plaited, extends down from the chin with a formal, geometric appearance and rectangular shape. The mask in profile shows that it is not intended to look naturalistic. The beard is held in place with a band beneath the chin, as it would have been in a ceremony. King Tut died around 1323 BC, aged just 19 or 18 years old, too young to grow such a beard. This, coupled with the fact that the mask has pierced earlobes, the preserve of women and children, has led some Egyptologists to argue that it was never intended to be used by King Tut at all. It was, they argue, designed for his stepmother, Nefertiti. Yet for ancient Egyptians, faces had symbolic rather than literal gendered meanings. Eyes, for example, had mystical connotations, as illustrated by the eyes of Orus and the eye of Ra, representing well-being, healing, and protection. Both male and female rulers wore fake beards in ancient Egyptian ceremonies and art to display divine power and royal authority. The principle was practical, and the practical was genderless. Hence, King Tut's mask resembles the gods Osiris and Ra, whose bodies were made of gold and lapis. An inscription on the mask reads, "Your forehead is Anubis, your right eye is the night boat of Ra, your left eye is the day boat, your eyebrows are in the company of nine gods." The mask was intended to be seen by the gods, not by humans. Such images were theological objects that transformed a corpse into a deity. Number 3, age before beauty. The Romans believed that wisdom, and therefore fitness to rule, was etched in the lines of the face. We do not know the identity of the artist or indeed the subject of the head of Roman patrician. So what do we see when we look at it? We might conclude from the richness of the drapery that this was someone important. After all, plebes and slaves were not sculpted in marble. He is a serious man with a poker-straight posture and solemn expression, whose face and neck are wizened by age. The skin on the forehead and balding brow is deeply lined by years of thinking and perhaps by responsibility. Earlier scholars suggested that the sitter was Cato the Censor, the famously austere Republican statesman. Yet we should beware making the mistake of thinking the sculptor aimed at realism or likeness as we understand it. This bust is an example of verism, a style of Roman portraiture that sought symbolic rather than literal truth. Roman sculptors and philosophers followed the rules of physiognomy that meant character was revealed in the lines and structure of the face. Why? Because Romans needed a visual language that demonstrated political legitimacy in a system where power was contested. In later centuries, it would be important for monarchs to have individually recognizable portraits for propaganda and coinage, but the rule was assured by blood or war. In the Republic of Rome, rulers showed their fitness in the experience, wisdom, and expertise etched on their faces. Women, wives, and daughters of those rulers were not depicted as aged and wise, because female value then, as now, was too often based on beauty, not intellect. Men could also be subject to gendered idealism, since a Republican politician often needed to embody not only the wisdom and experience of age, but also the physical prowess of a warrior. Some sculptural portraits had wizened faces, but youthful, vigorous bodies. Number 4. Why the long face? In the Middle Ages, religious portraiture relied on symbolism rather than realism to spread the word of God. Patricians symbolizing leadership in ancient Rome were concerned principally with their peers, the literate elite who read character in wrinkles. The medieval church faced a different problem. It needed to communicate to vast populations, most of them illiterate, many of whom were poor, none of them experts at what faces meant. So the church developed a visual language of symbols in portraiture. These symbols told viewers instantly who Jesus and the saints were, as well as religious martyrs, local landlords, and wealthy donors who invested in the church fabric. Madonna enthroned, for example, is one of the most famous examples of a symbolically laden portrait. Here, the Virgin Mary's image lacks the emotion and fleshliness of later artworks. Painted around 1310, Giotto's work was influenced by Byzantine tradition, which dominated Italian art, though he began introducing more naturalism. Gold leaf, bright colors, formal poses, and slender, otherworldly faces were what people expected from divine images. What made Mary instantly recognizable were her symbols: dark blue mantle, the white headscarf, the Christ child on her lap, the throne, the surrounding saints with their halos and attributes, the gold trim and background. She might be shown with a crown of 12 stars, roses, rosary beads, and a heart pierced by a sword. In a world before consumer capitalism, bureaucracy, in mass urbanization, personal portraiture that showed an ordinary person simply wasn't necessary. 5. The man in the mirror. By the 17th century, symbolism was being swept aside by portraits that sought to reveal the unvarnished truth. In 1659, the Dutch artist Rembrandt van Rijn sat before a mirror to capture his reflection. Unlike the Roman patrician Giotto's Madonna, there is nothing idealized about Rembrandt's self-portrait. What he produced was unflinchingly realistic. Rembrandt wears a dark coat and a black beret and stares out from a dark, featureless canvas. Nothing distracts from the face, the center of emotion, humanity, and the self, with a posture and expression that reveals emotion in the creases around the mouth and eyes. His skin is weathered, his features irregular, his nose is prominent, his jowls sagging. This is a man who has suffered. Rembrandt was careworn from a recent bankruptcy. His eyes meet ours, offering an invitation to connect. Unlike earlier self-portraits, Rembrandt created almost 100 during his lifetime. There are no elaborate symbols on display here, no artist's palette, no jewels signaling status, or books to indicate learning, or hourglasses to warn of time's passing. Self-portraits of his era reflect the fact that the status of the artist was becoming more important, as well as the idea of interiority and psychological individualism. Rembrandt's portrait is an archetype of modern portraiture. It betrays a feeling of face. We can see what he looked like as a specific, unique person, and the same face aging across different self-portraits. In medieval portraits, faces had been more stylized and generic, and painters often reused faces because they were not the focal point of the painting. With its radical approach to symbols, identity, and the face, the Renaissance changed all that. From now, the artists would seek to portray their subjects as distinctly individual and recognizable. Portraiture, then, did not only reflect a growing interest in the face, but also encouraged and perpetuated it, much as photographic portraits did in the 19th century. 6. What lies beneath? Photography forced artists to look beyond the skin to the sitter's core, with often unsettling results. This head of a woman was crafted in 1909 by the great Spanish artist Pablo Picasso. It is modeled on Ferdinand Olivier, an artist in her own right. Olivier is usually credited as Picasso's muse, yet flattery was clearly not a consideration in this particular portrayal of her. Picasso's head is roughly constructed with no attempt at realism. But why? To answer that question, we need to consider the dramatic technological changes that had convulsed the art world between the ages of Rembrandt and Picasso. When Rembrandt plied his trade, artists could make a good living. Their success came from their ability to capture some essential truth about appearance, to reproduce the world as it really was. But between the 1840s and 1870s, with the invention and popularization of photography, everything changed. Once a camera could capture likeness with mechanical precision, the project of realistic paintings became obsolete. If a camera could do in a few minutes what a painter took months to do, what was the job of an artist? For artists such as Picasso, the answer lay in achieving in their painting what a photograph could not, penetrating the core of a person to capture what the mind feels. Picasso's Cubist work embodies this approach. For all the head's lack of realism, skill is not an issue here. Picasso was accomplished at realism in painting and sculpture. Rather, the focus was different. The face was now a problem to be solved and understood, a structural puzzle, rather than an object to be copied. For artists that followed, such as Francis Bacon and the Surrealists, the artist's job was to ferret out what could only be discovered through their special insight. In such hands, and increasingly after the crisis of confidence caused by the First World War, the portrait was a tool for psychological investigation rather than social documentation. 7. Sweet scents and rotting flesh. This installation serves as a reminder that over the history of portraiture, not all faces have been equal. Today, the question is less how faces are portrayed, but rather whose faces. For centuries, the canon of Western portraiture has, for the most part, not included Black people. And where they were included, it was as servants, slaves, exoticized presences in paintings made by and for white subjects. There are exceptions. Frederick Douglass photographed repeatedly after achieving freedom, for example. But these are rare. For most of history, Black people have appeared as exhibits in the margins, in the background, or not at all. However, in the 21st century, artists such as Kara Walker have begun to subvert Victorian artistic styles, such as the silhouette, a medium historically associated with genteel portraiture, to critique the racist depictions of Black faces found in art and culture from slavery advertisements to blackface. In 2014, Walker created A Subtlety or The Marvelous Sugar Baby, a monumental installation in the Domino Sugar Factory in Brooklyn. At the center of that artwork stands a sphinx coated with 8 tons of sugar, the commodity that built American wealth on the backs of slaves. The face of the statue invokes that mammy archetype, Aunt Jemima, while the gaze stares straight ahead as impassively as the Great Sphinx of Giza, on which it is modeled. But the body is exposed and sexualized, as Black women's bodies have been in history. Around the sphinx are smaller gurus, molasses-covered children whose bodies are deteriorating, some with missing limbs and empty eye sockets. The sweet smell of sugar gives way to the acrid stench of rotting flesh. What is beneath the surface here is not some secret interiority, as was the case for Bacon or Picasso, but the question of who is being looked at and who is doing the looking. It is the nature of artistic production and consumption itself that takes center stage. Faye Bound Alberti is professor of modern history and director of interface at King's College London. Her new book, The Face, A Cultural History, was published by Allen Lane in February. You're listening to History Extra on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Our next story is Blood and Plunder, a tale of slavery, racism, and naked imperial power. Barnaby Phillips traces the fate of the exquisite golden treasures looted by British forces from the Kingdom of Asante 150 years ago. In a poorly lit cabinet in the Oriental Armory of London's Wallace Collection, there is a near life-size gold cast head weighing 1.5 kilograms. It is perhaps the largest gold object to have come from Africa outside of ancient Egypt. When this head arrived in England in 1874, part of the haul of treasure brought back by Sir Garnet Wolseley's army from the Kingdom of Asante in West Africa, it attracted widespread comment, not all favorable. The Times said it seems to represent the head of a victim gagged for sacrifice, and pronounced it ghastly. The Illustrated London News said it was hideous and horrible. But Richard Wallace, the wealthy aristocrat whose collection was later bequeathed to the nation, may have disagreed. Because he paid £500 for it, about £62,000 today. In 1974, William Fogg, a curator at the British Museum, said the Wallace head was a masterpiece, a technically excellent piece of lost wax craftsmanship, and impacted like a bomb on the complacent artistic sensibilities of Victorian London. What was the African civilization that had produced this golden head, and how did it and other Asante pieces end up in British museums and private collections? The Asante Kingdom traces its origin in the late 17th century when smaller kingdoms inland in the Gold Coast, modern-day Ghana, amalgamated under the control of a ruler based in the emergent city of Kumasi. Europeans were familiar with the Gold Coast, having traded there for gold, as the name suggests, but also enslaved people, ever since the 15th century. In the 18th century, Asante profited handsomely through both these trades, typically selling gold and human captives through Fonte middlemen to the British, Portuguese, Dutch, and other Europeans in their castles on the coast. But it wasn't until 1817 that a British delegation traveled some 125 miles inland to Kumasi and paid its respects to the Asante king, known as the Asante Haina. One of the envoys, a young man from Bristol called Thomas Bowditch, wrote that Kumasi was a wealthy city with elegant architecture and sophisticated public hygiene. The Asante Haina and his courtiers, he wrote, wore massy gold ornaments which glistened in every direction. Bowditch's descriptions caused incredulity and excitement in Britain, but his delegation failed to build a lasting friendship with Asante. By the early 19th century, Britain, hitherto an enthusiastic slave trading nation, had embraced abolitionism. The Asante Haina, Osei Bonsu, worried about this threat to his wealth and asked Bowditch whether the British king could renew the slave trade, which will be good for me. Over the following 50 years, as Britain tightened its control of the Gold Coast at the expense of European rivals, and as Asante maintained supremacy of the interior, there were sporadic tensions, notably in 1824 when a British invasion of Asante ended in defeat and the death and decapitation of the commanding officer, Sir Charles McCarthy, but also decades of uneasy Anglo-Asante coexistence. This all changed in 1871 when Britain purchased Elmina, the largest trading castle on the coast, from the Dutch, despite Asante's insistence it belonged to them. In January 1873, an Asante army swept south and invaded the British coastal protectorate to the surprise of William Gladstone's government in London. In May 1873, Earl Kimberley, the colonial secretary, said that any attempt to conquer Asante would be mad. But the ambitious officer appointed to lead the British response, Sir Garnet Wolseley, had other ideas. Wolseley, just 40, but already a veteran of wars in Burma, Crimea, India, China, and Canada, was determined the British would march to Kumasi. If the Asante Haina, Kofi Karikari, would not make peace, he would destroy his palaces, burn his capital, and lay waste his country as well as I could. While politicians debated, Wolseley shaped events on the ground. By January 1874, he was leading three battalions of British soldiers, plus many African allies and carriers, into the Asante forest. The Asante army, armed with muskets, fought bravely, but were outgunned by the British, equipped with new Snider rifles. At the Battle of Amoafo, many hundreds or even thousands of Asante soldiers, but only four British, were killed. One British sailor wrote that it was murder, not a fair fight. On the 4th of February, the British entered Kumasi, only to find that Karikari had fled. Wolseley, concerned about disease and encroaching rain, decided not to linger. Instead, he would leave the Asante with a wholesome fear of the British power. He ordered his soldiers to take treasure from the unguarded palace and then blow it up, and then to set fire to Kumasi to ensure its total destruction. Then he abandoned the burning city. Wolseley wrote that Karikari was a brutal and deceitful monarch. The British sense of racial superiority, Wolseley wrote that black people were suited only for slavery, had been reinforced by the apparent discovery in Kumasi of evidence of mass human sacrifice by the Asante. Gold is always pretty. On February 13th, the Asante Haina envoys caught up with Wolseley on his march back to the coast and agreed to a humiliating surrender. They handed over 1,000 ounces of gold objects, a tiny fraction of the 50,000 ounce demanded by Wolseley, but which included a significant part of the Asantehene's regalia, essential to his political and spiritual authority. A history of Asante, written by one of Karikari's successors, laments that the British were so impatient that it was not even possible to call any of the provincial chiefs into Kumasi to contribute what they could. So King Kofi Karikari was obliged to bear the brunt of this payment alone. Wolseley, who had already witnessed notorious plunders by British soldiers of palaces in India and China, drew a distinction between disorganized looting, which undermined military discipline and was therefore undesirable, and the acceptable collection of prize, to be auctioned off with the income shared among the troops. In accordance with his philosophy, when the British reached their headquarters at Cape Coast, they held an auction of treasure from the Asantehene's palace. The Daily Telegraph wrote, "The long center table was covered as thickly as it could bear with jewelry and gold. The prize agent had shown considerable taste in the arrangements of their stores, and gold is always pretty." The auction was enthusiastically attended by many of the Cape Coast elite, delighted by the defeat of the feared Asante. Many of the most valuable items, however, were sold in London in the spring of 1874 at Gerard, the crown jeweler in the West End. For most of the aristocrats and others who crowded Gerard's rooms, Asante objects were exotic souvenirs of a British victory, treasured as memorials of a recent struggle, as the Times put it. William Cecil, the Marquess of Exeter, for example, bought 2 gold badges and mounted them on gilt silver trays with his family crest and an inscription. In this way, what had been sacred objects in Asante were worn by officials responsible for the purification of the Asantehene's soul and became trophies. Decades of campaigning. The Asante people still referred to the 1870 war as the Sargrenti War from the local pronunciation of Sir Garnet. It was a seminal moment in their kingdom's decline. By the 1880s, according to their own histories, Kumasi was losing his power and falling into a ruinous state. In 1901, the British formally annexed Asante territory. They sent the then Asantehene into exile on the Seychelles Islands in the Indian Ocean, where he spent more than 2 decades. In 1957, the Gold Coast became the independent nation of Ghana, but the Asante people still revere their king and retain a strong attachment to their traditions. They have campaigned for decades for the return of the regalia. In 1974, the Asantehene wrote that the centenary of Wolseley's expedition marked an auspicious occasion on which to press for the return of objects of the deepest significance to the Asante. This set off a flurry of diplomacy. Some British diplomats argued in favor of returning the regalia, and the British Museum's director, John Pope Hennessy, told his trustees there is widely conceded to be some moral weight behind this request. But the negotiations floundered, in part because even British officials who favored flexibility could see no way around the 1963 British Museum Act, which makes it almost impossible for that institution to permanently return or deaccession items in its collection. In response to these developments, the director of the Asantehene's Museum in Kumasi said, "We want to get back as many objects as humanly possible. We just want people to see what our civilization was and how it can inspire the present. How many treasures the Asante people do get back and for how long they get to keep them is bound to remain the subject of intense debate for years." Barnaby Phillips is a historian and conservationist. His new book, The African Kingdom of Gold, Britain and the Asante Treasure, was published by One World in March. You've been listening to History Extra, formerly the BBC magazine, on Sunsounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, Kim Chupa Cornell. Music is classical British music by D'Lo Sound. Join us next time for an upcoming episode.